Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. This is a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight, my guest is Mary Duty. She is Director of Volunteer Services for AIDS Community Resources in Syracuse. She's been active in the fight against the spread of AIDS for 23 years. She was instrumental in the evolution of the agency from startup task force responding to the immediate needs of people dying with HIV and AIDS in a 9-county state-funded service agency now called ACR Health, and expanded their services to provide support to people with chronic illnesses. In the beginning, there were no AIDS survivors. That was 1990. Now, with prevention and medication, HIV/AIDS has become a chronic illness, and positive individuals regularly live into their 50s, 60s, and 70s, and hopefully beyond. During her tenure, she and volunteers were instrumental developing and expanding supportive programming for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth in Syracuse from 1998 to 2004. And so I'd like to introduce Mary. Mary, how are you tonight?
Thank you, David. I'm great. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I appreciate your willingness, and I have been looking forward to the interview. So I'd like to get right to it. One of the main themes of the show is spirituality, and I certainly see the work that you're doing as being spiritual, but I'd like to pick your brains and explore your background a little bit. I wondered if you could tell me what your family of origin was like.
Well, I come from a Catholic background. My mother and my father's grandparents were European, Irish and German, and I was raised in a family of 10 kids, and I'm the second oldest. And so all of that comes with its challenges.
That's a big family. What was your early religious and spiritual life like?
Well, being Catholic, and my mother was the organist to the Catholic Church, we, all of us from a very young age, were singing in the choir. We were attending every religious holiday, every religious service. We got released from the school to go to catechism classes, which actually went on until we were seniors in high school.
Okay.
So that's a lot of it. You know, it was very, you know, it was expected that you'd be at church, and you were.
And how did you feel about being at church?
I guess I was okay with it. you know, I enjoyed singing with my mother, and I enjoyed, you know, listening to her play the organ. You know, as I got a little bit older and got a little bit more aware of really what was being taught, because initially when I was younger, it was all in Latin. So you sat and listened to the service, but you really didn't know what they were saying. So after they switched to English, it was a little bit better. You know, as you learn things in school and you become a little bit more aware of what is being said.
Right, right. What was your early concept of...
Go ahead.
No, I wondered what your early concept of God was about.
Well, I don't know whether I always saw it, and my parents sort of portrayed it, and I also had my mother's mother lived with us, so my grandmother. And so it was a very punishing God. You know, if you do bad things, punished. If you don't do what you're told, you're going to go to hell, you know. The church portrayed it as a very punishing God.
Well, it's interesting because almost everybody I've talked to, their early ideas about God was that God was a God of judgment and that sinners would be punished. So you share the experience of most of the people that I've had on the program, and perhaps all of them, I can't recall. But I'm wondering how your concept of God has evolved over the years and what ways it might be different now.
Well, even your words of judgmental, I feel that was definitely very present, you know, judgment about other people, too. It wasn't a warm, embracing, accepting. You know, you were supposed to marry into the Catholic Church, and, you know, you couldn't marry somebody from another religion because they weren't good enough, you know, lots of judgment like that, that really sort of, I keyed into that judgment word when you said it. it brought back some memories. How's that?
Yeah. Well, has your concept of God changed?
That's a loaded question there. Because for me, I see myself as a very spiritual person, but I do question the presence of a God, one person to look up to. I guess I've always joked because for me, you know, I identify as lesbian, and that took a long time to become okay with that because of my experiences in the church. When I first finally realized that my attraction was towards women, I thought I was going to go to hell. I thought I was going to go to hell, like, immediately kind of thing. And it definitely attacked my initial relationship, because it was all in hiding and all really much in a state of denial. So I guess a big turning point was when I went to a workshop that was a week long at the Thornfield in Casanova. And it was lifestyles, gender roles, and sexual orientation. And, you know, we did a lot of processing with different people, with the group we were in. We did a lot of, you know, intensive workshops. And one of the workshops was about the Bible and sexuality and women and sexuality and things like that. And so it really changed my perception of my spirituality and God, my relationship to God. I've always said I was recovering Catholic.
I've heard that.
And then I evolved to I'm a recovered Catholic.
Okay.
And now if I really think about it, I'm just recovered.
Good.
Because my spirituality, as in a higher power. I know I feel there's a higher power out there. I'm very connected to the spirit bodies of the people I've lost in my life, and I feel they support me in all that I do. And I also have a very strong connection to my physical surroundings, especially in nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's where I find my center, my peace. Yeah.
Well, I think that resonates for a lot of people, and that's one way that people can get in touch with their sense of awe and wonder and feel connected to God. You mm-hmm. talked about the difference between, well, what I'm going to ask you now is, what do you perceive as the difference between spirituality and religion?
Well, I battled with that for a long, long time. I'm very fortunate to have these amazing people come through my life as a result of being at ACR Health all these years, and also dealing with people who are dying through, you know, my own life, but also through ACR Health, or AIDS Community Resource, as it was then. So I don't see spirituality, being a spiritual person, as having to have a connection to a formal religion.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't have to go to church. I don't have to go into a building to experience the spirit bodies in
right.
my world, or feel a connection to higher powers. A lot of times I joke and I say, my goddess.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that.
Because I need to take all the negativity that I have attached to a male god, you know, that figure, you know, I call her a goddess. And so I don't know whether I answered your question or not, but, you know,
yes.
I just, you know, it has changed. It has evolved for sure.
Well, can you describe your spiritual life today? Do you have any particular practices?
Different forms of meditation. You know, people talk about sitting in a space and just trying to clear your mind and focus
mm-hmm.
on your breath. And I've done that, and that brings me peace. And my other forms, and not a but other forms is when I'm out in the woods hiking, or particularly cross-country skiing, probably I get my most peace because of the silence out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in the cold. And then I also have experienced I feel very spiritual when I'm out on my bicycle, especially when I'm doing it for a purpose, not
mm-hmm.
just for exercise, but I felt very spiritual. It was a very spiritual experience for me to do the bike rides to raise money for AIDS, because I was doing those bike rides for all the people that had passed or had died because of HIV and AIDS.
Right.
And so those experiences were very connected to the universe and to the spirit bodies that are all out there supporting me in life. And so those were always those are always spiritual experiences for me. So
well,
that's
that
where
kind of segues. Yeah, that kind of segues into my next question, because I was going to ask you if you considered anything about your work spiritual. Is there anything else that feels spiritual to you about your work?
I never look at it like that. I just look at it as what I do, but, you know, I'm very passionate about education, things that have brought me great joy. Is working with the LGBTQ youth, but also working with people that need my support and my ear, and being able to listen and support them. So I guess it could be viewed as spiritual. I don't label it as such.
Well, you know, I've heard it said, and I believe this to be true, that all God wants for any of us is joy. So I believe when we're experiencing joy, we are being inherently spiritual. What do you think about that?
I never heard that said that way, but I could say that when the joy I experience, yes, I have, those have been my spiritual connections.
Well, I would like to go back a little bit in time. AIDS has been around for over 30 years now, and perhaps longer than that. Could you briefly tell us the history of AIDS, where it started, and what have been the misconceptions?
Well, yes, I can tell you a little bit about that. Well, in our country, we called it the gay plague back in
mm-hmm.
the late 70s. But just from looking at some history and doing some research and things, we found that, you know, a lot of people wanted to figure out who to blame, who's the cause. So really calling the gay plague or GRID, gay-related immunodeficiency syndrome, it was sort of that blaming the gay population, making the gay population the cause. But in looking back, HIV was around a lot earlier than we suspect. And back in, you know, the late 50s and early 60s, their remains were tested and found they were HIV positive. So it's been around for a while, and you know, it has, a lot of people died. I know when I first started working in this field 23 years ago, you know, we were experiencing a half a dozen deaths a month from just the people
mm-hmm.
we serve. That's
mm-hmm.
not, and that's, you know, our nine counties, you know, Onondaga County being one of them, and then we go all the way up the Canadian border as far
mm-hmm.
east as Herkimer. And, so it has definitely changed as time has gone by, you know, with Magic Johnson disclosing his status and other famous people coming forward have really changed the face of HIV and AIDS. The big struggles in the beginning was the misconceptions and the stereotypes that it was a gay disease or that it was an injection drug user disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people didn't pay attention as a result. And so right now the biggest infection rates, and it's significantly higher in all age ranges from young all the way up to the elderly, is African Americans and Hispanics. And the biggest struggles along the way is dissolving the misconceptions and the myths about how to get HIV and who gets HIV and AIDS and, you know, how to reduce your risk. And one of our biggest struggles is getting the African-American and, you know, Hispanic populations to pay attention and not believe the myths about HIV and AIDS. So so that has been the biggest struggle. Still continues to be the biggest struggle, especially because their churches continued to reinforce the stereotypes, you know, about who gets HIV and AIDS, and not focus
mm-hmm.
on what people do that, you know, gets them in a position of having HIV and AIDS. It's not who they are.
Well, what is the hope for people that are living with the virus or the disease?
Well, as you know, way back, it definitely was a death sentence. And people still, there are some people that still believe that. Some people that still don't get tested after all this information out there. But with early intervention, you know, and early testing, when you know you might, when you feel you might have been exposed, and then getting medical attention, as well as early intervention for women of childbearing age. You know, they're encouraged during prenatal care to get tested so that they can be, you know, monitored and get medicine so that, and do certain things so that the baby reduces their chances of transmission. All of those things have led this, I see, the, you know, the evolution of AIDS Task Force of Central New York. Then we were a community resource as the AIDS Community Resources, and now as ACR Health, serving other chronic illnesses. And I think it's perfect because HIV and AIDS has become a manageable chronic illness as long as you, you know, do what your doctor says, adhere to your medications. You can live a normal life. You can, you know, you can run, you can bike, you can go to work every day, all sorts of things. Doesn't have to limit you anything.
Is it possible for somebody that has AIDS to go into a form of remission and become undetectable?
They can become undetectable, but they're still they'll always have AIDS. If they got diagnosed, they'll always have AIDS, and they'll always be able to infect somebody else. What's undetectable is in their blood. In a blood sample, you know, it's not detectable in your blood, but it's still in your organs, it's still in your body, and you can still infect other people. And that's a misconception currently, too. I do community education a lot, and some people are HIV positive in the group, some are negative. You know, it's a variety of people, interns and the like. And that is, HIV-positive people do not realize that. They get that word of remission, and that's not a word that we typically use, but that comes from a doctor's office or something.
Well, we'll get into the concerns related to infection a little bit later. Right now, I'm wondering if you could, well, you basically have told us about the mission of your agency. Can you tell us what kind of response you get from the volunteer community?
Oh, sure. Well, volunteers have changed over the years. You know, in the early days, the volunteers were making a huge commitment to support people who had been abandoned by their families and maybe biological families, as well as maybe their chosen families. And so people were stepping up to the plate to provide one-on-one support, caring for them at home, being their health care proxies, and all those kinds of things. Those things are not happening like that anymore. So my team of volunteers end up being many people who are required volunteer hours, but also other people that just want to give back to the community. They might have lost somebody or have somebody that's positive, or they may be positive themselves. A lot of positive people do volunteer work still, as in the beginning. A lot of people who are positive and dying from AIDS were volunteers. But I have a lot of people from substance abuse programs who come do volunteer work as part of their recovery. I have a lot of folks that come for internships, positive people who have gone back to school and now want to start a new profession, start a new life, and they come back to do internships and or volunteer. I have a lot of people that have been unemployed, and in an interim, they'll come volunteer. And then, you know, then I have your people that provide some, that have been with the agency for 20 plus years, you know, some of my original volunteers that are still part of, you know, our, like our AIDS Walk steering committee, or they just come help us at every AIDS Walk or fundraising event or anytime I call them, that kind of stuff. So there's such a huge variety. I have about over 400 volunteers that I deal with on a yearly basis.
Well, I remember back in the beginning when it was called the AIDS Task Force that most of the volunteers were gay.
Yes, that's true.
Is that the case anymore, or has that changed?
Oh, totally not the case at all. It's a mix of people across the board. It's really interesting. The students that come to do volunteer work, they really get involved because it's a social justice issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've become passionate about it because it's a social justice issue. And also, I've had young people come because an uncle or somebody related to them had died from HIV and AIDS a long time ago when they were young.
Well, backing up just a little bit, you were talking about healthcare proxies, and I'd like you to talk about this with regards to people who have HIV, AIDS, or other chronic illnesses that could be life-threatening. What is the importance of having a healthcare proxy and or a living will?
I don't think it's important, but I think it's not just important for people with chronic illnesses or HIV and AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can walk out a door or get in a car or walk across the street,
right,
and be injured, not being able to speak for themselves, get ill very quickly. You know, so I think it doesn't matter what your it doesn't matter who you are, but just to have a healthcare proxy in place so somebody can speak for you on your behalf when you can't speak for yourself,
mm-hmm.
and to have all those things set up. You know, yes, as you get older, of course, you should get those things in place. But I see it really. I think it's important for everybody. It doesn't matter whether you have HIV and AIDS or a chronic illness.
Right. What is a healthcare proxy for those that don't know, and what are the benefits of having one?
I'll answer to my best of my ability, but I might not be thorough about this. But,
right.
A healthcare proxy is basically you're going to ask somebody to speak on your behalf when you are unable to speak for yourself, as might be on. You're going to determine whether you want to be on feeding life support for an extended period of time, or whether you're just going to want to pass away naturally. Also, it also will ask you whether you want to donate any of your organs, and it will ask you whether you want to use them for research or just a donation to save somebody else's life, especially if it was a traumatic kind of accident, like you got in a car wreck and you're brain dead, you can't speak for yourself, where this form will now, you will have stated what you want, and so then you're not leaving it to somebody else to make that decision, and then
mm-hmm.
having a structure as what you might have wanted. It's just like knowing. And it gets people in conversation about these things prior to the time it may be needed. And I think to go back a little bit, I always tell my volunteers when I'm training them, I think the best thing about HIV and AIDS is it made people talk about all the things people don't want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's death, dying, the realities of life. You've been born, but you're going to die at some point. We can deny it, or we can ignore it, but it's going to happen at some point. And so that you're prepared for that, and you don't leave it to somebody else to struggle with that and then have to second-guess themselves about whether they did the right thing.
Are you able to tell us what a living will is and what a DNR, or do not resuscitate, order is?
I've gone over the living will, but I can't remember exactly what it is. But I think it's just really making a plan so that, you know what you're going to do. I don't know whether it's just related to healthcare or whether it's related to everything. So
okay.
I'm out of the loop in that, more familiar with healthcare proxies. And then the DNR is do not resuscitate. That means you're going to let yourself go naturally. You don't want to be put on tubes and breathing tubes and all those other things in order to sustain your life when you just don't want that.
Right, right. Okay, well, let's talk about current misconceptions about HIV and AIDS.
Okay.
I'm going to turn it over to you.
current misconceptions about HIV and AIDS. I think they're the same misconceptions that have always been there.
All right. Well, let's review those then.
Yeah, the misconceptions are that you, one of them that totally frustrates me is the fact that the, gay men are assumed that they all put themselves at risk, number one. And some all put themselves at risk of getting HIV. That's one misconception, because I know that's not true. So another misconception is people think you, some people think you cannot get HIV from oral sex. And we know that's not true. It's probably less riskier than some other ways, like injection drug use with an unknown person with unknown status or vaginal or anal sex. But there's still risk, because I've known people who've gotten HIV infected through oral sex. What are the other misconceptions? There's misconceptions that women can't transmit the virus to women. And go ahead.
Can the virus be transmitted by saliva?
Oh, that's true. Some of these basic things. Sorry. No. The virus can't be transmitted by kissing. But if there's blood present, then there's risk, because blood carries virus. So the fluids that carry the virus are blood, pre-cum and cum, both the clear and the milky fluid, mother's breast milk.
Oh, okay.
And vaginal secretions.
Okay. Who are the people that are most affected by the virus in this country? You've talked about some.
The highest infection rate are 13 to 24, that age range in there.
Really?
Yeah, but the infection rate is quite high, higher than you would even imagine for 50 years old and older.
Okay.
For a variety of reasons. In that group of people, if I remember my stats, I can't remember. I think I know the African Americans are 12 times higher risk than Caucasians, and Hispanics are.
Why is that?
A lot of it is not wanting to accept the fact that all people are at risk. So being stuck on the stigma and the myths that only gay people and injection drug users can get HIV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is still taught in some churches, especially, and people who come out as gay can be kicked out of some African American churches. So.
Crazy.
They have in the past, and it still happens. And So it's those misconceptions about who can get HIV and how it's spread, and refusal to educate and get knowledge about it, and just continuing to spread myths about it, keeps people in a state of denial, so they don't take care of themselves.
Well, let's talk about education. First of all, I have a question. I've heard a term called bug catcher. Can you describe what that is and why it is so risky?
Well, there have been people who try to get HIV and AIDS. And so they have unprotected sex with known HIV positive people. They
why?
Choose to. I can only project on why. I don't know what
mm-hmm.
their mentality is, but I have heard and read articles and had people report this to me in trainings and the like, that sometimes people want to get the bug so that they can be part of a group, you know, so they can be part of, people are always want to be part of something, and so then they're part of this group of HIV-positive people. Also, for some other people, it's for so that they can get the services that are available in the community for HIV-positive people.
What would be the benefit of being part of that group of infected people?
That's a question to ask those individuals, because for me, I wouldn't want to have to take HIV meds for the rest of my life. Once you start them, you're on them for the rest of your life if you want to stay healthy.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about HIV prevention. What constitutes safe sex?
Well, I've never called it safe sex. We always call
okay,
it safer.
Okay. Good. Well, let's educate people about that, because I've heard both terms used.
Yeah, it's safer sex because there's a lot of dependence, but the 100% sure way not to get HIV and other STDs, of course, is abstinence. And the second best way is a monogamous relationship with a known HIV negative person. To be not sexual is not very human. Humans need to, most humans want to be sexual beings, want to experience, you know, the connection with another person. And so, you know, safer sex for us is using barriers, not coming in contact with those fluids I talked about, and that's blood, vaginal secretions, pre-cum and cum, and then, of course, blood, breast milk. But it's about using condoms every time, not just occasionally, but every time. Not getting vaginal secretions, exposure to vaginal secretions through oral sex is another way. And then people do a lot of different things, and it's important to use whatever is needed, latex gloves, you know. I always encourage people to have their adult toy box and have it filled with all the things you might want to use to be intimate. I feel two people who are being intimate, sexually intimate, should be both committed to safer sex, and so they should both participate in it so that a condom or a barrier or a dental dam whatever.
What's a dental dam?
A dental dam is, maybe a 5x10 piece of latex. Like, it's the same material, a little bit thicker than a condom, because you can get really thin condom latex. But and you can make a latex barrier out of a condom. You can make it out of a latex glove. You can use saran wrap, but it's a barrier so that when you're doing oral sex, either vaginally or stimulating somebody orally in the anus, then you have a barrier so that you're not coming into contact with their fluids.
Okay.
So it's between their body and your mouth.
what kind of condoms are not safe and what kind of lubrications should people use with condoms?
Well, let's start with the lubrication. Because they're latex, and just like the also the dental dam or latex barriers, you need to use the water-based lubricant, because anything oil-based is going to make that latex fail. It will make it break very easily. You can practice yourself. You can take a piece of latex or put a condom over your hand and rub some oil on it, vegetable oil, olive oil, petroleum jelly, anything like that on it. Rub it on, and it will tear. It will tear it because it breaks down the latex. So that's,
even a skin lotion, right?
Yep, even a skin lotion, if it has oil in it,
mm-hmm.
It's going to. So that's why water-based lubricant. You know, they're great because they actually provide a little heat and extra stimulation, so it makes it more sensation by using and when you're using the barrier. And then the condoms that you shouldn't be using. Oh, there's also not only latex condoms, but for people who are allergic to latex, there's polyurethane condoms, and we give all those things out free at ACR Health and for people. And then also the condoms that you don't want to use to protect yourself from HIV and other sexually transmitted infections is lambskin. Lambskins,
mm-hmm.
Lambskin condoms are only, their only purpose is to prevent pregnancy. So they have these holes in them. You can't see them, but they let the fluid out, but they don't let the sperm out. So they prevent pregnancy is what they do. But the fluid is what carries the HIV. That's why they don't do any good when it comes to preventing infections, HIV and sexually transmitted infections. And then the other thing that we really advise and have never passed out condoms with this material in it is non-oxynol 9. And it's a spermicide that's put on some condoms. And what we found is that lubricant, non-oxynol 9, can be an irritant to both the skin of the penis and the lining of the vaginal walls or the anus. And if those areas are irritated because of the non-oxynol 9 and you're not practicing safer sex every time, then you have a port of entry where infections can get into your bloodstream.
Now, is it true that when you're using a polyurethane condom, that it's okay to use an oil-based lubricant?
I have never heard that. We always just advise water-based lubricant.
Okay.
Because the female condom, I don't know whether you're familiar with that, but it's a condom that can be inserted into the vaginal canal, and there's a ring in the end of it, and it will sit up against the cervix. And so a woman can put in, that could be inside her body for 6 hours. So if she knows she's going to be put in a situation or not be able to advocate for herself because she might be out on the town, you know, drinking or something along those lines, she'd have the condom inside of her and still be able to practice safer sex.
Mm-hmm.
And we still advise all water-based lubricants for that also, and that's polyurethane.
Can a man use a female condom?
Yes, man or woman, it doesn't matter their gender. If people want to use that condom for anal sex, all they have to do is remove that inner ring and then insert that condom into the anal canal so that they can have protection there also.
Okay. Well, now I've got a couple of... Go ahead.
That's just another misconception that only
men have anal sex.
Right.
And
even lesbians do.
Yeah, exactly, with sex toys or whatever. And it's important to, when you're using sex toys, that they are kept clean and you use condoms over them and you don't share those either. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, it's about washing them, but it's also about not sharing them.
Mm-hmm.
Or putting a new condom on it every time. You never should use a condom twice. You know, it's all, it's all about practicing safer sex the whole way.
Let's get into a couple of other common misconceptions that I believe are misconceptions. First of all, can a person who has the virus but is undetectable have unprotected sex with little risk of infecting others?
I don't know what the medical professionals are saying, so there's probably lower risk. I would assume that there's lower risk because the virus is lower count, but the blood and the you know, when they're testing, it's only the blood that's undetectable. You still have the vaginal secretions and the becoming cum that are still can have just as much HIV in them. So we always encourage people to practice safer sex.
I understand that there was a Swiss study that was done. This is not in concurrence with what is said here in the United States, but they said that it's okay for somebody that's on the meds and is undetectable to have unsafe sex with others. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
That was a few years ago.
We still always, the New York State Department of Health and ACR Health still always advocate for safer sex. That means using a barrier.
Okay.
When you're positive. And if your partner is positive too. Sometimes folks, there's another exception. A lot of times positive people that are partnered think they can practice unprotected sex. And
what's the danger for them?
Because the virus, people, there's different, I'll call it strains of the virus.
Mm-hmm.
Different strains of the virus. And if you get infected with a different strain of the virus, then you have this mutated form of virus in your body. So your medications that you were taking may not work anymore. So then your viral load will go up again. So then the doctor has to try to find different medications to manage this bug you have now, which is a different strain. So if you do that often enough and, you have a lot of partners and you get reinfected with different strains of the virus, then it becomes more and more difficult for the doctor to find a combination of medications that will control your virus. So you can end up with a superbug, which is hard to control and hard to find medications that control it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard that the virus is, how can I call it, that it's actually difficult to infect somebody with the virus, that it dies when it's outside the body, and that it usually takes repeated exposures before somebody's infected. Is that true or not true?
Can you restate that? Because I thought the beginning of what you were saying is a little out.
What I've heard is that it can take multiple exposures before you become infected. Not to say that there's not risk the first time and that you can't get it the first time, but that generally speaking, it takes multiple exposures.
Oh, I see it as, I've always seen it as, from the get-go, as a game of Russian roulette.
Mm-hmm.
Some people may not be infected the first time they're exposed, and then other people are going to be infected the first time they're exposed. So I don't think there's a rule as you won't get infected right away. I think it's a game of Russian roulette. Depends on the person, depends on the scenario, depends on what you're doing, depends on how rough it is, whether there's microscopic tears in the vaginal walls, anal walls. Depends on your genetics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many factors to weigh in there. I don't think you can. It's always been a game of Russian roulette, and I think will continue to be.
Let's talk about viral load. Now, somebody mm-hmm. that's undetectable has 50 or less, whatever the count of the virus is. Now, somebody that's infected and that doesn't know their status could have hundreds or tens of thousands or more copies of the virus in their bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that true? No.
Yes. Yep.
So for somebody to have unsafe sex, period, whether they know somebody's status or not, is putting themselves at risk.
Correct.
And perhaps even greater risk if somebody doesn't know their status.
Yeah, because, and even for somebody who's not taking their meds properly, if they do know their status and they're not taking their meds properly, they can
mm-hmm.
have a very, very high viral load too.
Mm-hmm.
Be very risky for another person. So, yeah, it's important to know your partner's status.
And just because you test negative one day and have sex the next day doesn't mean that a few weeks later you're still going to be negative.
That's great. Well, when you get HIV, they're testing for HIV antibodies, not the virus. So it will take anywhere from a month to 3 months to develop enough antibodies to get an accurate test. So the New York State Department of Health advises 3 months. A lot of people will test accurately after a month. But there's a percentage of people, 5%, that won't test accurately until about 3 months out after infection. So you've got this window period where, you know, let's say you got infected and you didn't even get tested, or you did get tested. Let's say you didn't get tested. You have this whole period of time waiting up to that three-month period before you should get tested. That you could be infecting other people.
Right.
If you have an unprotected sex, right.
Well, I would like to say one thing as a recovering sex addict. Sexual addiction puts people at an incredible risk because sex addicts, the disease is progressive and they take greater and greater risks, and many of them do not have protected sex. And I would like to self-promote my latest book, Shades of Gay, which is a story about a sex addict. So if you'll bear with me for a minute, Mary, I'm going to play a commercial on Shades of Gay by David Clark.
Oh, sure thing. I can't wait to read it.
Well, for whatever reason, the commercial's not playing, so I guess it's not meant to play. But for anybody that's interested in the book, it's about an alcoholic and sex addict that takes incredible risks, not only the risk of the relationship, but puts themselves at risk of AIDS. And I may choose to try playing the commercial again in a moment, but for now, Mary, I'd like to ask you, do you see any spiritual meaning for the disease?
I think I sort of said that before. I think it just the HIV and AIDS has created a platform where people can get more in touch with themselves, with their families, by talking about things people don't normally talk about. You know, HIV and AIDS has made us talk about death and dying. It's made us talk about sexual orientation. It's made us talk about addictions, things that people like to ignore. So just having that stronger connection with the people in your lives by being honest and truthful, I think there's a benefit there.
I once heard, speaking of death and dying, the death and dying expert, the late Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, once said that she believed AIDS was here for a spiritual reason and that it would not go away, and that was that we needed to practice unconditional love, and until we could do that, that AIDS would not go away. What do you think about that?
Oh, love it. It's so true. It's what just more articulately said than what I was saying, but it's the same feeling. Same feeling, you know.
Yep. Well, I'm going to try to play the commercial one more time, and if we're not successful, then we're going to just have one final question and end the show.
Excellent. Okay.
Prepare to be shocked. Prepare to be moved. Prepare to laugh. Prepare to cry. And prepare to be inspired. Dive into David Clark's latest book, Shades of Gay, and you will find yourself plunged into the trenches of sexual addiction. You will embark upon a kaleidoscopic tour from the abyss to higher ground. In the beginning, it was love at first sight when Daniel and Mark met, but through the years, that same love became tainted. Daniel, an alcoholic and sex addict, has found himself unable to resist the lure of other men. When Mark discovers his infidelity, he leaves Daniel, who begins a dark descent into sexual tryst after tryst. Shades of Gay reveals the myriad desires a lost man can permit his body and soul to revel in despite the pain they bring. But can such fleeting moments of pleasure bring meaning to life? Will Daniel realize the love he had with Mark is worth more than the sweat spent in other men's beds?
And to answer that question, you can purchase Shades of Gay on Amazon.com, where the book is discounted, and it's also available in Kindle form. So my final question for you, Mary Duty, from AIDS Community Resources, now known as ACR Health, is our guest tonight. And I'd like to ask, what is the future hope for those living with the virus?
Right now, I think it's become a manageable chronic disease. And I think that's realistic in the near future. I hope at some point they do find a cure, but I think people have to look at it as a manageable chronic disease and proceed in that direction.
Well, thank you, Mary, and thank you for joining us tonight. It's been a pleasure, and the hour has gone so swiftly, and you've been so open and honest and provided a reservoir of information for people that may still be in the dark or that may not be up to date with HIV prevention. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, and at ACR Health, I do a monthly training session, usually on a Thursday evening, and people are more than welcome to attend to get more information.
Great, and how can they get in touch with you?
Our number is 315-475-2430, or my email is volunteer@acrhealth.org.
Great. Well, thanks again, Mary.
Thank you, David. It's great talking to you.
Likewise. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.